Never one moment did I ever wish that I was Korean in Korea. I mean, I pride myself in my heritage, but being American is the thing that I really cherish. And I'm very grateful to this land for the way I've lived and the way I can think and the way I can speak. I mean, freedom. I mean, people who don't understand the lack of freedom cannot, you know, really appreciate this country. But in 1945, you know, they had all these funny governments in Korea. And so, you know, we never would have been able to adjust to our way. And even today in Korea, they don't have the freedom we have here. You know, freedom of speech, freedom of thought, freedom of action, you know. I cherish that.
Yes.
You know, I mean, if people don't have it or people can't contrast it to something, then it may be a lost cause, you know. But I don't think I'd like to be a Korean.
Can you tell me about your career in the Navy? In some of these articles here, it was saying you were the first Asian-American woman in the Navy?
Yes, yes. I was the very first Asian-American woman in the Navy, and actually probably the first Asian, because they did not accept, you know, Asians before. Then 6 months after I was enlisted, and I went and was working on Miami, Florida. I was stationed as a link trainer operator. 6 months later, they recommended me to officers training school. And it was done by a reserve officer out of California. I mean, it's very ironic, you know. Anyway, I went to Smith College at that point and got my commission. And because I had some link training experience, they selected me as the first female to go to Pensacola Gunnery School. And so I became the first woman gunnery officer in the United States Navy.
So what did you have to do as a gunnery officer?
Well, I only taught. I mean, I taught theory, you know. They had a simulated thing, you know, how you should shoot the zeros in the air and everything. And I just taught, you know, from that machine. However, I had all kinds of sub-lieutenants, you know. We had chiefs, petty officers who were experts in marksmanship. And so my gunnery school was very well taken care of.
Yeah. So when you were selected to go to gunnery school, was it with the idea that you would teach or that you would actually be in an airplane?
No. And in those days, there was no such program as to go actually into be a fighter pilot.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. So they what they wanted to do was to have people trained in the gunnery field, the women in the gunnery field, so that they could release the men to go out and to go into overseas.
And so it was a kind of economic.
Yeah, well, that way, if they needed the manpower, the women would stay on, bases, and the men would go out. And that was the philosophy in those times.
So how large were your classes?
Well, I had some, I don't even remember, 30, 35. Oh, I had one commander. He was a 3-striper, I was a 1-striper, and he was about 6 feet 5 inches tall. He was a fighter pilot. Now, the fighter pilots have a different personality from bombardiers and transport pilots, etc. You know, they're feisty. Well, anyway, and they had to come back for a refresher course. You have to go through my class. This guy looks at me and he says, "I'm not shooting till I see the whites of those Japs' eyes." I said, "I don't care what you do up there. Down here you do what I tell you to do." God. But, you know, you have to hold your own. First of all, you're a woman, you know.
Yeah, I was wondering how they responded to you.
I had no problem. I mean, maybe it was the way I behaved, I don't know, but there was no in fact, there was a bunch of fighter pilots coming around all the time, you know, and we lived in the same barracks, you know, same officers' quarters, I should say, and we all shared the same social halls, but never had any problem.
Then at a certain point, did other women start?
In fact, the program didn't go on that well. What they did was they trained a lot of enlisted women as gunnery people. And so there weren't very many gunnery officers in the Navy other than myself. So
then what happened?
Then the greatest blow to my ego came. I was at Atlantic City as a gunnery officer for a year and having fun. I mean, God, you know what, you have 5,000 fighter pilots and you have one ensign gunnery officer woman, you know, it was heaven.
You felt very strong.
And because I was the only female officer there, I was very well treated. And they had a great program of athletics, and I was very athletic, so it, you know, all helped. So one day I get a call that I have to go to Washington, D.C. And this is through the Secretary of Navy's office, and I was stunned, you know, but somebody looked at my jacket and saw that I was Korean, that I could speak a little Korean, read and write a little Korean. They picked that up. This is way before the Korean War, you know, still fighting the Japanese.
What year is this then?
1943 maybe. And so they send me to Washington, D.C. to Naval Intelligence. Well, nothing but waves, not one man in sight. I thought, gosh, this is not where I should be. So I called up this admiral, because he's the one that was responsible for transferring through. I said, gosh, I said, get me out of here. And he says, now, Susan, he said, if they ask you to carry a glass of water, I know you'll do it gracefully. That was the end of my fussing. So I get to Naval Intelligence, and they never had an Oriental before in Naval Intelligence. And first of all, they can't clear you, you know, because when they clear a person for security, they have to go 2-3 generations back. Well, we're what, just first generation into the United States, so, you know, how can they examine what your background was in Korea? So they really didn't know what to do with me. I mean, but because I was sent in by the Secretary of Navy's office, I mean, they couldn't do too much to kick me out or anything. But they were really worried because they had me filing with the enlisted girls for, I don't know, several months because they didn't want to show me any secured documents. And they were really afraid of me, you know, really, really afraid that I would be espionage, I guess. In fact, when I reported on the station, the captain of the station put on an alert and said, "Who is that?" So my commanding officer, my immediate section officer, had to go up and explain to him. But anyhow, so what they did eventually...
That must have been a hard time, a hard adjustment. Also, because, you know, if you were filing, I mean, it must have felt just sort of demeaning.
Well, you know,
that, you know,
yeah, but, you know, but I didn't have that feeling. Yeah, you know, first of all, I'm not sensitive to anything. I mean,
obviously.
Yeah, no, I mean, if this is the way it is, this is the way it is, you know. I mean, I really am an accepting kind of a person. My son thinks it's a very bad trait, but it makes an easy way to live, you know. I mean, I have no qualms. I have no... problems, actually. But so I sat there and I filed for several months, and then they what did they do with me? Oh, they sent me down to the Library of Congress to do the research.
That was sort of a safe thing.
That was sort of the safe thing. But in the meantime, They had, from the Library of Congress to the Office of Naval Intelligence, where I was working before, there was no communication, so that anytime you had some material, you'd have to pick it up and you'd have to carry it back to the station. Well, anyway, leave it to me. I found an annex, a Navy annex down on the subfloor. And so we established a communication system from that to the Naval Intelligence building. So I sat in that communications thing for them. And then what I did was able to do was to, the Library of Congress has different little research rooms, you know, and they call them cubicles. And somehow or other, you know, just talking and being around, I was able to establish a cubicle for them. So that you could do your own private research and then go down to the Navy annex and send out your information back. Well, I think that went on for 6 months, and they finally thought I could come back to the office and be a code breaker.
Really?
Mm-hmm. But it was, you know, but as I say, none of that really bothered me as being, you know, put aside or anything like that. But I had lots of friends, and everywhere I went, I mean... Oh, and then eventually the captain of the station and I became very good friends, you know. But I just had a ball, actually. I mean, everywhere I went, I was liked, and I made friends all over the world. I still have friends, like I have one in Vermont whom I served at Miami with, and she always calls me up and tells me to come, you know. I don't know, it's been a good life. Mm-hmm. In 1956, I was working, by this time the whole intelligence outfit had gelled to become the National Security Agency. And so I was a civilian working for the National Security Agency. And in 1955, 56, I guess they gave me a fellowship to come out and study at USC. So fortunately, my husband was overseas, you know, because my mother had not spoken to me for 5 years because I married a...
Oh, yeah, I want to go back and ask you about this. We forgot about your husband. When did you meet him?
Well, let me see. When did I meet him? Probably in 44, maybe, because he had come back from Hawaii from a station, and
he was in the service.
In the same kind of an outfit. We're all security checks, you know, and the same thing, which made it easy, you know. Otherwise, it'd be difficult for you to even talk to them, you know. In those days, we were much more security conscious than it is today. And so, but he came back, and he had known some waves out in Hawaii. And when they got stationed back with Washington, D.C., they said, there's a Korean girl down there that they wanted him to meet. So they introduced
him. Why was that?
Well, because he was so fond of Koreans out in Hawaii, and all these girls knew it, you know. So they were being very friendly to him. And so one of my friends introduced me to him, and I thought, oh, you know, I was not too impressed, you know. But eventually he kind of grew on you, you know. So that's how come we finally got married in 1947, you know. But my mother, for 5 years she didn't talk to me. I mean, which wasn't as bad as it sounds, because my sister and my brothers kept in contact with me all the time. So it was only her. And then I was in Washington and she was here in Los Angeles. So it wasn't like, you know, one of those isolation things, you know. But it was that she was very unhappy.
Why?
Because I had married this white man. Oh, my goodness, she was really...
What did she say? What did she expect of you? And
Well, I don't really know what she expected. Maybe to be stay single, because I was 32 at the time that I got married, and she and Dad were both hoping that I'd find a nice Korean man and be homogeneous, I guess. But you know, I
do people are kind of arrange marriages at all?
The Koreans?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I have to tell you about that. We used to get, they call them chungmae, they were marriage arrangers. We used to get them all the time at our house, you know, and sometimes they'd bring the fellas, you know, even for my sister and myself, both of us.
You mean other families were trying to?
No, like no. There's a person who's interested in your welfare, so he thinks that this man is a good match for you. And so he's going to bring him to meet you at the house, okay?
One of these marriage arrangers.
One of these marriage arrangers. And these marriage arrangers can be a professional or they can be a friend of a friend, you know, just somebody that's interested in your welfare. Well, anyway, my sister and I, oh, God, we used to have a fit. But they bring these marriage arrangers plus their client. And my sister and I used to run upstairs. We had a two-story house. We'd run upstairs and hide. And my mother used to have the problem of facing these people. And so one time she said to us, she says, "The next time I lie for you girls, don't make any noise up there." Oh, God, I tell you, we had some time.
So starting at what age were they bringing the eligible bachelor?
Oh, I'm not really sure. I think at that time I must have been 18 or something like that. Sarah was 16.
Yeah. And sort of that whole idea was really just abhorrent to both of you?
Oh, repulsive. Abhorrent, just
Was that because you had ambitions of pursuing a career?
Oh no, it was just a repulsive idea. You have someone come to you and say, you know, marry this guy, and it never worked out because there were always somebody from a Korean background, you know. But if you know, it's really strange because if you're born and raised in this country, you live with a sense of freedom and, you know, do whatever you need to do, you know. I mean, there's really no curtailing your activity. Mm-hmm. And
were there other Korean Americans?
Who were victims?
Yeah. Or did that pretty much die out?
No, that... Well, they keep trying, but it never, I don't think it really took effect in the second generation. I think they all kind of married their own choices, you know. I mean, it was just something that we didn't,
Do you think your mother was, you know, she didn't make you, you and your sister, meet these men?
No.
Was that sort of just because she had made her own choice, or...
Well, that might be it, but I think that she kind of respected our feelings. Yeah, she was a very wise, mm-hmm. wise woman.
But it was still expected you would marry
a Korean
American.
Yeah, right, exactly. Which neither one of us did.
Really?
No, Sarah married a Scotchman.
So, well, you kind of paved the way for her. Maybe it wasn't so bad.
Well, by the time that she got married, which was years later, it wasn't so much that I paved the way for her, but she was older and very mature and well into her. At that time, we were running the restaurant. And, you know, I think my mother was kind of adjusted to the idea. I don't know how to explain this, but my daughter was the one that really kind of brought us all together. Ironically, my husband was overseas, and I was alone with my only one child at that time. And my brother was getting married, and so they were going to have a reception, and my mother said to Philip, "I wish Susie was here." And my brother didn't say one more word. He came on the phone and he says, get out here as fast as you can. So I brought my daughter and came out, and she was 2.5 years old. Fortunately, she was bright. Fortunately, she took to my mother. And so that was the blending of the first union. And the daughter made a big hit with Grandma. And very lucky, she had dark hair and dark eyes, you know, because, you know, if she had blonde hair and blue eyes like my grandchildren, it would have been a little bit harder for my mother to accept. And so then that was, you know, great, because at that we had a reunion, etc. But when my son was born, she came to Washington, D.C. to take care of him, Korean style, you know, all the mothers come and take care of the newborns. And she came and took care of him. And then she became very fond of him because he was a boy, you know. Always, you know, they're brought up with that. I guess that's the way it is. And so he's been lucky to have her as this kind of a spiritual guardian. And then in 1956, you know, I got that fellowship and came out, and I lived with them. And they had a huge house at Victoria Avenue.
Where is that?
Victoria and near Adams and
the West Adams.
Yeah, uh-huh. In that area, it was one of these huge Victorian houses, with just wonderful, huge big rooms, hardwood floors, and so I came and I lived with them. My sister was there at the time, and here I had the two kids and I brought them in, and there was enough room for them, and so I took a year graduate study.
What were you studying then?
You know, it's really ironic how all these. I mean, I have not done anything with it, but in the I had taken up East Asian studies, and this was before the Vietnam War. You know, so the only thing I did was wrote some papers on it, but I'm sure that someone else would have done a more scholarly job than myself. Then when I went back, I had to stay 2 years because that's what. You know, if you go on a mission like that, you owe them 2 years. Mm-hmm. And after the 2 years, I developed these very migraine headaches, and I just, you know, it was very difficult for me to cope with it. So when I went to the doctor, he said, what you need is a vacation. And in the meantime, my brother, Philip, had said, please come out and help us. We need your help at the restaurant.
What was the restaurant?
It's called the Moon Gate. Restaurant. That's another fabulous story. It would take you.
Oh, I have to hear that. You have to tell
yeah,
that.
Yeah, really? Okay. It's really. Anyway, so we. What happened? Yeah. I talked to my supervisor, and it was okay. And so I told him that if my husband. See, one thing that I was lucky was. Since I was more or less a key person to the operations wherever I was, they let my husband choose his stations if I wouldn't go with him, you know, if I stayed behind. So he always got choice stations. And this time when I said, then my husband said, well, what do you want to do? I said, I think I better resign, you know, because I have two kids. You know, and
little kids,
and I began to think I didn't even know what they're thinking. You know, I mean, it was just, you know, career first and family second.
Who was taking care of them?
I had a nanny, a wonderful black nanny, mammy. Not yeah, but she was absolutely genteel. In fact, my daughter and she corresponded until I think last year, and she didn't get a thing from him. So we figured that she was going on. But it was just a precious relationship. And how that happened, that's another story that's interesting. In those days, a woman didn't go back to work after she had a child, right? I mean, it was kind of uncalled for.
So, this is what, the 50s?
40s.
Late
40s? 50, because she was born in 50.
Okay.
So I went to the pediatrician and I said, you know, I don't know whether I should go back to work or what I should do. He looked at me, he said, if you could find a nice mammy, that child would be better off.
Oh, then you staying home?
Then me staying home. Well, that was a blow, wasn't it? But I guess it was quite obvious what I was like. Anyway, but we found this mammy. God, she was just wonderful. Sweet, genteel, very feminine, and just thought Christine was the queen of the earth, you know. So we got along very well on that score, and so it wasn't quite a problem then. But then when I had the second one, eventually she had to quit, and so we had to find another one. And we found another one that was not equally as good because she wasn't as genteel. But she was big and buxom, and she could box flip you around. So she was okay, too. So she stayed with us until we left. But I don't know. It was so harassing, you know. I have two children, not knowing what they were thinking. And I'll tell you another story about bringing up children. At one time, Christine got very cranky when I came in the house, and she was, you know, just fussing and not very happy. And the mammy said to me, she says, Miss Cuddy, she says, I don't know what's the matter with that child. She says, but she's perfectly fine till you come in that door. So I told this to the pediatrician, and he said, well, he says, I know what you do. You come home, you throw off your coat, you dash into the kitchen and start dinner. That was exactly what I was doing. He said, don't do that. He said, don't take your coat off. Don't do anything. Sit down and hug your child. Talk to her. And then do your thing. Solve the problem.
Wow.
Isn't that wonderful? In those days, we had such a good pediatrician. Yeah. But anyway, that was another story about bringing. So eventually, it got to the point where I felt that I should, you know, come home. And so I said to my husband, you know, what shall we do? He said, well, what do you want to do? You know, same old question. So he found out that he could get transferred to a place called Imperial Beach down south near San Diego, because that was the only comparable station. And when we went to find out actually to get the transfer, they said, no, they're closing that station, but we can send you to Long Beach.
Which is even better.
So they sent him to Long Beach, and I resigned, and I came out, and I went to work at this great place called the Moon Gate Restaurant.
Can you tell me the background about that restaurant?
Well, it's such a big, long story, and I have a whole box full of Moon Gate. You want to cut it off or do?
Oh, we can just keep going. Maybe if you just tell me.
Sorry.
That's okay. Sorry. I think the cord is long enough.
It's right here.
Okay.
Let me see if I can just. I can just give you a little bit. I've got about 8 things of these. But this was our wine list. This was our building, and we had that in front.
Oh, so when was it built?
1954, they opened.
And whose project was this?
It was actually Sarah's project, my sister's project.
Yeah, and how did it
develop into a family operation?
Mm-hmm.
Well, when my mother got into the act, she said, you know, let's make it a family operation. And so my sister broke off her partnership with the fellow that had started it with her. And she brought in all the brothers and sisters as part of the thing, and my mother was on it. These are our cooks. Oh, this is one that, you guys, you're right. But we had dignitaries of all kinds.
So So here it says Philip Ahn's Moongate.
Yeah, well, we took Phil Ahn's Moongate because his name was already known, and it was an asset. They, you know, studied the whole areas and found that Panorama City was the heart of the San Fernando Valley, and we expected it to be just great guns. But about 1987, 86, it started to deteriorate, you know, and there was white flight. All the American families that had lived in the area moved to Costa Mesa, to Agoura Hills, and Nevada. And so what we were left was the Latin element. And, you know, they're not coming, I mean, they're not coming into a big fancy place like this. And so we decided that we were going to have to sell. So in 1990, we sold to a Mexican nightclub man. So that's a nightclub now.
Wow. Yeah. Booked for what? 40 years almost.
So what, with 1954 to 1990?
35 years.
35 years, 36 years. Yeah, so. Oh, you saw
so,
all these things.
That was really focal then for your family. Did what roles did each person in your family take in the running of the restaurant?
Oh, okay. Well, Philip used to be the maitre d', you know. Then as he got older, you know, he kind of retired from that. And in the early years, Ralph was one of the bartenders, and then eventually but he had other jobs like being a coach and an athletic director at schools, you know. And then, but he would be a maitre d' also, and Sarah was the evening maitre d'. I mean, she did all the night shifts, poor thing. And I did the help wherever I could, but I was the office keeper. I did all the books. I did all the banquets. We used to have some huge banquets, some really good ones, 300 people. But
and your mother?
And my mother would sit and bring her guests in, and she would be Mrs. Queen Bee. She loved that. I mean, you know, after her hardship years, she got paid as a director. And, you know, gave her own independent means of getting along, and she could donate her money to these organizations.
Oh, yeah, because she was made the director of the restaurant?
Yeah, made on the board of directors, and
right.
So they paid her.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, which I thought
and
was.
So she finally had some money.
Of her own that she didn't have to ask any of the siblings, you know, so she was independent. Now, very ironically, she had a birthday party the night before her death. And her old cronies were there from way, way back, and she had a very good time. But it was a very strange phenomenon. As she came in that day, she went to the kitchen and shook hands with every cook, you know, which was strange. And so she came and she had a nice party. And then after she got home that night, Philip was out of town, and one of the fellows that was staying there called me and said Mom was sick. So I rushed down there and called everybody to go. And so when they called the doctor, they thought maybe she had a heart attack. But then the family got into a little bit of a disagreement about how we were going to get her down there. Shall we call an ambulance? Shall we drive her down? You know. So I said, well, let's go ask her. So I go into her bedroom, and she says, I feel okay now. You know, and that was her comment. So so we called the doctor, and the doctor said, well, if she feels okay, just leave her, and we'll bring her in tomorrow. So my sister stayed there that night, and the next morning, my mother got up and tried to fix breakfast for my sister. Do all these normal things, you know. And eventually they got together and they went down to the hospital. And so she was under observation. And so we were calling back and forth. And I don't know why, I was especially tired that day. So I told Sarah, she was down there, you know, with her. I told Sarah, I said, I'm so tired, I don't think I'll come down. And so she said, well, that's okay. She said, because I'm here. Hour later, she calls up and says, Mom's gone. And Sarah was there just talking to her, you know, but she just... And fortunately, my brother had gone, the second brother, Filson, had gone there to see her at lunchtime because he worked at Hughes, and he just came... It was at St. Vincent's. And so, and she told him that, you know, she was fine, that it was everything was okay. And so, but what she did was she just closed her eyes, and she was just went off very peacefully on her birthday.
How old was she?
86. 86. But she went off into the... Then when we let everybody know, you know, my brother Ralph didn't show up. Yeah. And I thought, oh, God, this is the time when it's finally gotten to him, you know, because he was always so good about accepting everything, you know, about his life without a father. And
he never met his father?
No, he never saw his father. That's another story I should tell you. And so I thought, oh, this is it. This is when he's, you know, really gone to pieces. You know. But he comes in eventually. He's made all the funeral arrangements.
That's where he was.
Huh? That's where he was. Oh, God, I thought. But it's just to show you what kind of a woman my mother is. My father was leaving in 1926, and she was pregnant 3 months, and she didn't tell him. She didn't tell him, you know, because she didn't want to burden him, you know. And so he went off, and and then Ralph was born in September. And always we thought that someday he would see his father, you know. I mean, there wasn't a question in our minds that he wouldn't see his father. But it's so strange that time never came. And he, but that article says about him, you know, that he kind of accepted this as the way of life. So he was never perturbed, you know. And mother being the strong woman she was, evidently was both mother and father to him, and it didn't matter. And then, of course, Philip and Filson were so much older than he also that he had a male image around also.
Oh, what's the age difference?
Let's see. He's 10 years younger than me, so he would be 20 years younger than Philip.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Did Philip... is the oldest.
Philip is the oldest.
Did he sort of take a father role in
well,
the family?
Well, that's another story, too. When my father left in 1926, he said to Philip, he said, in the eyes of God, I am a sinner, but I'm leaving you the responsibility of the family.
In 1926?
In 1926, yeah.
Where was he off to in 1926?
China. He was going back to China. He had come in 1925, and he only could stay a year. So he went back to China in 1926.
And what happened then when he went to China?
Oh, then he was still in the independence movement. I'll give you an article on him. You can take it with you.
Okay. But so, when was he imprisoned and when did he die and how?
Well, he became very ill. He was. Let's see, I think this tells... he says...
Just as you remember it, you know.
He was imprisoned in 1932, taken as a prisoner in 1932, because some Korean had thrown a bomb to some Japanese official. And he was more in that, you know... That people were looking for the person who threw the bomb, but somehow or other, he had promised a young child that he would bring a birthday present to him. And father, being the kind of person, he's always kept his promises. So he, in spite of the fact that the area was being searched, you know, he took the present, went to this home. And that's where he was picked up by the Japanese officials.
And then in Shanghai?
In Shanghai. And then from then, of course, there was a no deal with the Japanese. Once they got him, they were going to. So they took him to Korea and charged him with the Peace Preservation Act and imprisoned him for a term of 8 years, I think. And
oh, is that the period where he's writing to your mother every 2 months?
Yeah, yeah. Right. And in 1936, he was released on probation. And at that time, the Japanese said to them, you know, if you will you stop working against the Japanese government? And my father said, as long as whenever I eat or whenever I sleep, as long as I have a breath left in my body, I will always work for the independence of Korea. And so he was, then after 4 years he was released, but they imprisoned him again in 1936, and 2 years later he got sick. And Ralph heard the story, I think this is one of the articles that I wrote, about that he was very sick, but when he went to the hospital, he asked him, when he was dying, asked him to push him to the window so he could look out over the land he loved.
And this is in Korea?
This is in Korea, in Seoul.
So when he got out of prison and then he was sick at that time?
Yeah, no, he got out, he was released on probation in 1936.
Right. And then what year did he die?
38. Then he was imprisoned again after 1936, not too long. Oh, before, it says before they went into South China, before the Japanese went into South China. Uh-huh. And he built a home while he was on probation.
Just tell me.
Well, it was a home that he built in the mountains. It was called Songta. I'll show it to you after we take this off. It was supposed to be a model home, a kitchen that was made up especially for the convenience and expedience for the housewife. It had a sign someplace, they tell me, that had the American word smile, because he liked the word smile very much. And I'll show you the stones that he set up as a walk, and everything is upright, but that was his principle, everything is upright.
Oh, you mean he set the stones so they were facing up?
Yeah.
Vertical?
Yeah, vertical.
Making a fence?
Just making a garden or a walkway. Uh-huh. But when I show you the pictures, it'll...
So he designed it?
Yes, he built it himself with the help of one carpenter.
Really? And this was in Korea?
This was in North Korea. That's where his home was.
Uh-huh. And did he want your family to come there? Was that going to be his base?
That was going to be his base, yeah. Because my cousins did live with him there as a home. So, really, it's a beautiful spot. I asked about it, and no one was able to tell me whether it's still standing or not.
Wow.
You know how the communists are.
Wouldn't it be amazing to be able to visit that?
Oh, that's one of my dreams, I mean, to be able to visit and see what he's done. You know.
I know I have more questions for you. How are you doing? Do you need to break, or...
I should go to the bathroom.
Okay, I'm going to put us on
hold.
Stop.